Philadelphia's had its share of police officers and chiefs whose accomplishments and fame are known well beyond the city's borders. Frank Rizzo and John Timoney readily come to mind. But the most decorated cop in Philadelphia history is the focus of a new book by historian, author, and Philadelphia resident Harold Gullin. Now serving as Upper Darby Township Police Superintendent, Mike Chitwood and author Gullin join me on Newsworks Tonight. Gentlemen, thanks for being here this evening.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Harold, the title of the book, Tough Cop Mike Chitwood versus the Scumbags. Explain.
That's a term he uses when he wants to keep it, you know, reasonably clean, to characterize, you know, all the evildoers, everyone who really the police are working against. And it hasn't changed. You'll note in the book, it hasn't changed. Sometimes he thinks he's still 50 years later dealing with the same kinds of criminals. They almost seem like the same people. So that's why it's a versus the Scumbags, the term he always uses. In fact, they have T-shirts he'll tell you about the Scumbags to raise funds for schools and things in Upper Darby.
And, Mike, the story begins with your birth growing up in South Philadelphia in a time that's much different than now. It's the South Philadelphia of the 50s and 60s.
Different world. The players were different. Unfortunately, the crime's the same, except it's more violent today than it was back in those times. But there's still one issue that always remains the same, and that's the human interaction. That's where you're successful, being able to interact with people.
We mentioned Frank Rizzo at the top. To what extent was he a role model for you? He was certainly somebody who interacted with people.
When I first came on the police department, Frank Rizzo was a deputy commissioner. And I was in a short period of time when I was involved in a shooting. And the then commissioner was Howard Leary. And he was not happy with my actions. It was myself and another guy. And I can remember Frank Rizzo called me at home on a Saturday afternoon and said, look, I reviewed everything. Don't worry about it. You'll be fine. And that was my first interaction with Frank Rizzo, and that was probably 1966.
Harold, a lot of themes.
I should have put that in the book.
There are a lot of recurrent themes in this book, which we'll get to, but it is a slender tome, but boy, there are a lot of cases that are cited, many of them famous to anybody who's been in this area, among them the Ira Einhorn case.
I could have written twice as long, and maybe there'll be a sequel or something about updating Chitwood, but that actually wasn't, I suppose, the most significant experience that he's had, because he just happened to be there, you know, at the time to find her in the closet, to find her decomposed body of Holly Maddox in the closet.
And so, Mike, what are cases that more readily come to mind in terms of your involvement?
Well, I think the one case that probably changed the direction of my career was the Nicoletta Caserta case. That was a young girl who was sexually assaulted and stabbed in the heart and choked. And I became personalized in that tragedy, because when I saw the body on the scene, as a homicide detective, you're always going to the scenes of these horrific crimes. And I saw her in her school uniform. And I looked at it and I said, oh, my God, it looks like my daughter. I didn't realize at the time, but it played a tremendous amount of emotional drain on me. And we were fortunately working with other detectives. We were able to get the doer, Henry Fahey. Eventually, he was arrested and charged. We took a confession off him. We found the murder weapon where he led us to, the knife that he used to stab her. Her blood on the knife, his fingerprints on the knife. So we had a grand slam home run as far as convicting him. But I can remember going through the whole process of the investigation, and it took several months. And we found out that this Fahey was, to use my terms, a real scumbag. And he had been accused of raping little boys and little girls, and he was just a notorious bum. And I never really paid attention to the case after I took the confession and, you know, had the preliminary hearing. It was in and out. But then as the trial started, and I had this perspective of the family, which was very, very negative, and that was a mistake on my part. That was a human frailty that I realized later on in life that I was 100% wrong, because that was their daughter. They loved that kid. But I missed that. I said they come from a certain neighborhood, they dress a certain way. The stepfather was a career criminal. In fact, he was the prime suspect when we first started investigating it. And then as time went on, and I get up and I start to testify, and I break down on the witness stand. And the jury's crying, I'm crying, the courtroom is, the victim's family's crying. And I couldn't believe it. I was here. I had this Dirty Harry macho type image, and all of a sudden,
when you woke that morning and knew you were going to court, you didn't know then that you'd have this emotional component that would otherwise penetrate your professionalism on the stand.
When I got on the stand and I started reading, and I'll never forget the statement. His statement to us was her saying, "Hanky, hanky, please don't hurt me." And when I started reading that thing, I got all choked up. And I had they called a recess twice, and then they called lunch. And I walked from City Hall to 30th and Market and back trying to compose myself. And I can remember walking back, and one of the reporters for the Philadelphia Daily News grabbed me. She said, "I've never been a Chitwood fan, and I can't believe I saw what I saw today. What happened?" And I took a step back, and I said, "You know what? I realized today that I was a human being, that I wasn't a robot. That I did have emotion and I did care." And I said, and after that case was over, he got convicted of first degree murder. He was sentenced to death in an electric chair. I felt relieved, but then I thought to myself, you know what? This is 17 years of shootings and hostage situations and the different dramas that I had been involved in. I said, I need to change. I got to go a different direction. And it took probably another 2 or 3 years, and I had my first police chief opportunity in Middletown Township. And one day I was a homicide detective. I was the next day I was a police chief. I said, "Wow, what do I do now?"
I think we kind of surmised that kind of changed Mike's life, and that he thought he would make the transition from dealing with crime after it takes place to dealing with prevention of crime. And it's perfectly understandable that when he was finally in this position he had had the equivalent of a doctorate in dealing with crime on the streets. I mean, but here he is sitting in this enormous office, you know, with his big desk, and just thinking, well, he had talked to, specialists in terms of how you package yourself, you know, when you're applying. And finally had his first opportunity to be an administrator. And I don't think it was so much, what do I do now? Although that's the way we phrase it, is how do I do it? And so he called the guy who had sort of channeled him, you know, through how to do these things. Ultimately, he got some academic enrichment, which was necessary these days to be a chief of police, superintendent of police. So much as, well, what do I do now? And the guy laughed, and then he said, "Well, you know, you find who the really good people are, and you back them up, and you give them the kind of recognition they deserve." And Miller, it's common sense stuff, but it's pretty much parallel the way he's run the rest of his life.
And we learn, Mike, in the book that those lessons in delegating serve you well, not just in Middletown, but where you served for the longest, and that was Portland, Maine.
Correct.
Let's talk a little bit about Portland, Maine. Let's talk about guns in Portland, Maine, and your positions at variance with those of the many of the community members you served.
I've never been a big gun fan. Whatever you believe in, I mean, I could be responsible for killing a little baby during a shootout where my partner was shot, and I didn't, thank God, I didn't shoot. And that kind of changed my career, too, with respect to guns. And, you know, over the years, I saw what guns do and how horrible they leave people's lives.
But fast forward to the present, and now we're post-Sandy Hook, post-Columbine, and on and on and on. You feel defeated in terms of foreseeing a day when there will be adequate gun legislation?
I don't know if there will ever be adequate gun legislation. I mean, I fought that battle in Maine. I mean, I can remember the first week I'm there, I go on my desk and there's 50 concealed weapon permit applications that I have to sign. And I said, "What do I got to sign these for? I don't even know these people." So the first thing I did, I said, "Well, what's your background check?" "Well, we don't have background checks." I said, "Well, you don't have background checks?" So I refused to sign them. Next thing I know, the attorney general from the state of Maine is sitting in my office. I said, "I'm not signing them." He said, "Well, you have to. It's the law." I said, "I am not putting my name on something, and God forbid somebody goes out and kills somebody with that." So I refused to sign him. They didn't know what to do. Next thing you know, there were editorials, tar and feather me, send them back, Sportsman's Alliance of Maine, NRA. And that went on for during most of my tenure. And there were a few times we won, like guns and housing projects and guns and churches, and where we were able to keep them out. But that was a continuing battle, and I saw how powerful the NRA was, you know. And I would get calls, I only kill what I eat. And I'm thinking to myself, wow, this is out of control. I mean, commonsensical gun things. Is it going to solve everything? No, but background checks, the mentally ill having access to easy access to guns. I always use the word, it's easier to buy a gun than it is to buy a cheesesteak in Philadelphia.
To what extent is your view shared by fellow employees in the law enforcement realm?
Well, guys that have been around and worked the streets, I think, have an understanding. I mean, there's a lot of hunters, and I support that. You know, hunters and people who legitimately can get a gun. I don't have a problem with that, but it's the proliferation of firearms in our communities. It's just insane. I mean, you hit these drug houses now. Inevitably, you're going to come up with a gun. We hit a place the other day. Two guns, both stolen out of Philadelphia. Now, you know and I know those guns are going to be used to hurt somebody. We got them. Then what I do is I burn the guns. Every couple of years, I burn the guns. Well, that causes an uproar. You can't burn the guns. You should sell them to a license. I say, if I sell them, they're going to be back on the street. So why not burn them? So I melt them down.
Harold Gullin, though, for every article tar and feathering Mike Chitwood, your book leads us to believe that there are far more gold plating him. Is there a middle ground on Mike Chitwood?
I think by and large, without getting all gushy about it, Mike has had a pretty favorable press almost everywhere he's been. Almost everywhere he's been, they wanted to run, at least somebody wanted to run for public office, and he's always turned it down. I don't think he would find the same excitement every day and the same, you know, thrill that he does to this day. I mean, he's just, as he says, he's just as excited to get into the police work today as he was almost 50 years ago. But I think the main complaint has been he's Media Mike, as one guy called him, you know, in Maine. He loves publicity. Well, he loves publicity because it's good for the police to have publicity. It's good for people to know the police chief is out there, to know who he is, to know what he's saying, to know what he does. And I think by and large, that view has prevailed. I think it's prevailed everywhere.
The book touches on the vetting process to become police chief, first in Bucks County, then Portland, and now in Upper Darby. Mr. Chitwood, if you were qualified for and were offered the job as Philadelphia police superintendent, there is an election coming up for mayor in a couple of years, and the mayor typically appoints his or her own police chief. Would you be interested in that position?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I would be interested in anything. Let me say this, Tito. I start my 50th year next April. And the passion I have for my job has never changed, ever. And right now where I am, I got the best of all worlds. I got a great department. I got great political support. And I have whatever status I want, I mean, in dealing with crime. But certainly Philadelphia is where I was born and raised. I spent 20 years of my career in Philadelphia. So
we mentioned John Timoney. He and Bill Bratton are distinguished police chiefs who are now doing consultant work. Would that alternatively interest you as well?
No. No, I love what I'm doing. And as long as I can be proactive and have a positive impact on the community and department, I'm going to stay doing what I'm doing.
Who is the intended audience for this book? It certainly resonates with those who've been born and raised in the Philadelphia region and know the history of the Frank Rizzo era, the John Timoney era, et cetera.
Of course, I see it not merely as a regional book but as a national book because it's universal in the things that it says. When he talks about sane gun control and when he talks about hostage negotiations, of course it's focused on this area. He's on something almost every day talking about it. The only regret I have is that I didn't write a little bit longer because I'm finding out just listening to Mike that there are things I didn't know that I would like to have, like that he tasered himself to show what it was like. I mean, I maybe I should have asked more questions. But
well, allow me. Mike, what's it like to be tasered?
It hurts. And why I did that is we just implemented tasers in the police department. And I wanted the community.
Which police department?
Upper Darby. Mm-hmm. I wanted people to see that this is the technology that has been in place and that we have ordered it. And I felt, what better way to do it than stand up front and get hit? And let me tell you something. When I read these reports and they say we tased him twice and it had no effect, I say, wow, this guy's got to be strong if it didn't have any effect.
In retrospect, do you think you were nuts to subject yourself to it?
No. It is what it is. You know, I mean, it's like a drug raid today. I'm usually not the first one in, but I'm usually the second or third in on a drug raid.
Well, you both seem pretty solid to me. Thanks for joining us on Newsworks tonight.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That is Philadelphia resident and historian Harold Gullin, author of the book Tough Cop, Mike Chitwood versus the Scumbags. Also joining me is Mike Chitwood, Upper Darby Township Police Superintendent.